Hey there. Welcome to The Unpresentable Parts, your go-to spot for conversations that matter, hosted by Tim Blake and Titus Walelo. We're breaking down barriers and building bridges, one story at a time. Tim and Titus invite you into a space where the vulnerable becomes powerful. Ready to join the conversation? Let's dive in.
Hey, welcome to the Unpresentable Parts podcast. My name is Tim Blake. Normally, I'd introduce my co-host, Titus Walelo, but he's not with us today. We are going to be introducing a new series entitled Views from the Valley. It's based out of Psalm 23, verse 4, in which the psalmist writes, "Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." And you've probably heard that before. I've read that a billion times, probably heard it long before I ever became a Christian. In movies or whatever it is where someone's quoting the psalm. I never really understood it and glossed over it until I realized later on in life in my walk with God that there are valley seasons in our walk. And so we are going to be doing several interviews with people who have gone through valley seasons. And the aim and goal is to help us have some tools and have people that we can relate to that have also been through valley periods. We're going to talk about grief. We're going to have some talks about mental health, anxiety, and depression, of which I suffer. Learning how to deal with hardships in the valley, things that are quote unquote unfair. How do we deal with that stuff? How do we find hope? How do we see that there is another side of the valley when we come up on out of it? And so it's called Views from the Valley. And so prayerfully, this series will edify you, will be helpful for you. Today, our first interview is going to be with James Dunn, who's got an amazing story. And we'll welcome him in now. Hey, James.
Hey, how's it going there, Tim? Excited to be here and appreciate the work you're doing.
Come on. So grateful. James, my experience with James, he spoke at a cancer survivor service that we had in November of 2023. So every year in our fellowship, The Heart, we have a cancer survivor service. And James did one of the best testimonials I've ever heard. Honestly, we didn't even need a sermon that day because between all the other sharing and then James sharing, it was amazing. But at this time, I want to introduce James. And James, let's get a little bit of your story. Let's start with your wife and children today, and then we'll work backwards.
Yeah, sure. No, well, definitely, as I mentioned, excited to be here. Live in Southern Connecticut, so I'm about 40 minutes from that New York border, although I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. Wife and I have been married just over 14 years. Proud parents of three kids. Two girls and a boy. And my son and daughter, ironically, my son will be going on 8 years old at the end of this month, and my daughter will be nine. We go on vacation for the 10 days. They'll both be 8 years old, and she turns nine on the last day. So they're like Irish twins. My first daughter, not to get overly deep off the bat, but one of my valleys is my oldest, youngest daughter, Aaliyah. Actually passed away when she was 4 months, 3 days old. So that was 11 years ago, just born with a rare heart condition. But that was definitely a valley time. But I always, whenever I introduce myself, I still say the proud dad of three children, even though one of them passed away.
Appreciate that. And we are going to talk about that. And we're going to have an opportunity for you to share a little bit. So when did you said you're from Boston. So kind of give me a little background on your faith journey.
Yeah, sure. You know, I was raised by my mom, was a single mom. My mother was a teen mom. She got pregnant with me when she was 15, had me at 16 back in 77. So I'm going on 47 years old this year. But, you know, so grew up single mom household. Grandparents pretty much helped raise when we were really young, but mom pretty much raised me. Inner city of Boston, so we were low income. I've learned not to say I grew up poor. I used to say that, but I met some people that experienced some real poverty, and I'm like, dang, I was rich compared to them.
Comparatively, I was like, right?
So now I'm like, you know, I grew up low income, but Section 8 housing, subsidized housing, food stamps, way back before EBT cards, you know, we had the Monopoly money back in the day, where it was like we're going to the store. And it's interesting because at one point I may do an article that says I went from WIC vouchers to wealth management now in the financial field, but, from handcuffs to wearing French cuffs. So I'm like, yeah, it's been a journey. But I grew up inner city Boston gang life. You know, it was we were the neighborhood crew that were just, we didn't start trouble with folks, but the gangs were really bad and rampant in Boston, Roxbury, Dorchester, aka the Berry, Dorchester, they called Worcester, Mattapan, Murderpan. When I was 13, from the age of 13 to 16, I know when I counted it at the time, it was 19 guys that were killed.
Oh.
Within a 3-year period that were just in my social circle, folks that I knew of or were family of folks that I was close to. I've been shot at 3 different times in my life. Not it's not cool like in the movies where they make it all dramatic. I was lucky that the people weren't after me personally, but it was more so the crowd I was with. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky that I've never been shot, you know, but it's one of those things where it was a whirlwind. You know, a turning point for me was losing my mom 3 weeks before my junior year of high school. So that was like, you know, she died of AIDS in 93. This was before when a lot of knowledge about it wasn't really known. Mm-hmm. I was confused because I'm like, how? She wasn't into drugs, hadn't had a boyfriend in years. But I found out that she had it when I was younger. And she died 3 weeks before junior high school. So that was a whirlwind. So that was kind of Boston gang life, you know, mom's passing. And really from there, moved with my uncle. But I was really battling depression and just did not know how to talk about it. So I ran away from home, dropped out of high school and was like, you know, I don't think I'll ever finish high school. Slept on floors and had to steal food to eat. So day to day, I was like, am I going to make it? Do I even want to make it? And there were times where I was just like ready to end my own life. And I just remember complaining about, man, I didn't ask for my mom to die. I didn't ask for my father to not be present. Didn't ask to be homeless. And I was really a blame shifter by nature. Then I feel like I was crying out to God one night on a bench in a public park at like nearly midnight. And he's just like, yep. So what do you want to do? And I'm complaining, like all this stuff's happening. I was crying to the point where my eyes were bloodshot red and burning, stomach acid burning because I hadn't eaten in days. And I just felt like it was God's voice, like, okay, so that happened. What do you want to do? And I just kept complaining. And then I finally paused and said, I want to live, you know. And what I realized is when I wanted to end my life, I didn't really want to end my life. I wanted my suffering to end, you know. So it was a rude awakening when it came to personal responsibility. Because by nature, I kept saying life's got to get better than this. And it wasn't until smoking weed with some older OGs in the neighborhood, and they were like 25, 27, and I'm 16. We're smoking weed, and I just said, life's got to get better than this. And one of the guys said, life's what you make of it, N-word, you know that. And I was just like, that's true. So it was like this epiphany at age 16 where I'm like, wait, what am I making of it? You know? And so that was a rude awakening. I was the older brother. I really had my mom till I was about 14. At age 15, when she got sick and died at 15, she started to lose her memory, and she had a form of like dementia. It wasn't diagnosed dementia, but the AIDS itself was actually attacking her brain. So she actually forgot I was her son. So it was really like, you know, I had one parent for 14 years, emotionally, you know, technically for 15. And I just had a whole lot of emotional issues that I was just like, I'm really underdeveloped. And, so that was my start in Boston. You know, but now all that happened, mom passed away about 3 years, you know, before kind of meeting other folks within our local church and getting introduced to how to have a relationship with God.
Wow. You're not a visitor to the Valley. Like, what did Bain say?
Yeah,
said,
I was born in it. Yes.
You've only adopted the darkness. I was born in it, molded by it.
Love that. Love that my cheesy Wayne impersonation. I'm saying Wayne Bane impersonation. He's like, or perhaps he's wondering why someone would shoot a man before throwing him out of a plane. I'm like, yeah. But but love that. You merely adopted the darkness. I was born in it. I'm so true. But yeah, it's such a powerful statement. I love those quotes. And I heard Sam mention that she's like, I probably have a million quotes, you know, in the prior podcast. I'm like, for me, those quotes are like, man, just mental vitamins, you know, that plant that seed. But yeah.
Come on. So you became a Christian in our church in Boston in what year?
1996, July 21st. So this is coming up on 28 years. Okay. Which I met some folks and studied the Bible and then chose to become a disciple of Christ or follower of Christ.
And so, you finished high school, or how did that work out?
Just finished high school. Talk about God's timing. I was like, hey, my uncle was like, hey, once you graduate, you pretty much need to get a plan to either work or get out of house or whatever. So I'm like, I have no money. So I was looking at the military. I did 2 years of Army ROTC in high school. Mm-hmm. Boston English High School, by the way, oldest public high school in America, which I didn't even know until junior, senior year. But I graduated there in 96, and I was basically going to go to the military. I was looking at the Marine Corps just because I was like, hey, I qualify for the GI Bill, be able to live rent-free, get some job training, and get money for college. So I was like, hey, let me go that route. I was supposed to leave. My scheduled ship date was June, and then it got bumped back to September. Mm. And I actually got invited out to the church end of June and July. And then chose to like literally study the Bible for 2 weeks and learning how do you have a relationship with God? Because I was like, there's a lot of religions out there. I never even thought about a relationship with God. I was like, that's a new concept. I just thought, how do you know which religion has the truth? Yeah, I was thinking of it intellectually with my head and not my heart.
Okay. So you become a Christian. Did you end up going? Did you get deployed? Did you end up going? Or no?
Yeah, so I had already signed the contract to get deployed. In fact, my recruiter and I were so tight that we're almost the same size then, and he gave me a copy of his dress blues uniform, which was like $400 or $500. And as an 18-year-old, I'm like, oh, that's very considerate. I still have them to this day, almost 28 years later. But then I decided, just in terms of my own faith, I was like, I'm just learning what this means to have a relationship with God, how to be a Christian. So I was like, I don't know if traveling around to different states or countries is going to be good for me spiritually. So I prayed about it, thought about it. And although there's nothing wrong with being in the military and being a believer, I just chose not to at the time. Yeah. I did have to wrestle with, hey, if I breach the contract, that like you could get locked up for 30 days or get fined a certain amount of money. Mm-hmm. I spoke with the head sort of officer there and gunnery sergeant, and they were like, hey, just think about it. And spoke to my recruiter. I was like, I prayed, and I just think that I really should stay back. I was like, I'm not going to complain about the consequence. So if I need to get fined or spend 30 days in jail, I'm surrendered. My recruiter, Staff Sergeant Cleveland, who I still keep in touch with, he just said, hey, you know what? We're talking. And he's just like, when God calls you, God calls you. So, hey. And I was like, I was shocked. They actually said, yeah, we're not going to force you to go. I got a letter, which I still have, from the commanding officer in charge that said, hey, yep, we're going to release you from the contract. If you ever want to come back, just bring this letter. I actually gave up that scholarship. And the same day I found out they released me from the contract, I got 3 job offers as an 18-year-old. So I was like, wow, God's grace. But,
great. And now you mentioned my wife, Sam, earlier. Now, you guys knew each other in the campus ministry, right?
That's right. Campus ministry. Sam and I met, and I think it was January 99 when she came down with like Glenn Petruzzi and a few other folks who had moved into on staff and part of the campus ministry there. So I remember Sam when she was Sam Neptune. And I don't know if this is if it's hot tub time machine or hot sub time machine, but Sam looks exactly the same. So she has not aged at all. I'm like, man,
there's a great American philosopher that coined the phrase, black don't crack.
That's so true.
They didn't lie. But in any
so
case.
True. Yeah.
So you start working and then you went to college, correct?
Yeah, I started working. What's funny is I did a smaller, like 3 month certificate program, and I actually worked in the financial field before going to college, just doing like some entry level accounting type stuff. But I was like, all right, it's great to work when I'm 19 or 20, but fall of 98, I was like, I do actually want to go to school. But you know, I was living on my own, and then that's when I started college at that point. Fall of 98, met Sam in January 99.
Okay. And so you met your wife just after college,
Yes.
you're working, you met your wife. How did y'all meet?
It's funny. I was in grad school at the time, working full time, doing an MBA. A mutual friend of ours, which was from Boston, we're part of the same fellowship there. She's like, "Hey, you should go out on a date with a friend of mine." It was so I'm in Boston Singles Ministry. We had another singles ministry in Connecticut. They're like, "Hey, there's a poetry open mic night, you know, to share whatever your talent. It's going to be at her home." So we met, and then my wife has, similar to Sam, with the unique last name of Sam Neptune, my wife's name is unique. It's actually the Russian version of Claudia, but her name's Klarvdia, you know. We discovered, though, that the Russian version is actually like Klavdia without an R. Her mom added an R, so we think she misspelled it back in the 70s there. But
That's how my wife got her first name, Samantha. In the islands, and her name was supposed to be Samantha, and story has it that a member of the
Gotcha.
family that was given the birth certificate to go take it to register it pronounced it even phonetically Samantha. And so they end up Samantha. She's the only one on the plane. So I got one
No,
to
so
meet,
every
just like
time I
you.
Google her name, I'm like, I don't see it anywhere except for her. And then a buddy of mine, a random fact on our honeymoon, he actually came to the last resort on the same day we're in Mexico. I'm like, what are the odds? Him and his wife, our last day there was his he and his wife's first day there, and his wife was Russian. So then we, as soon as she heard the name, she was like, "Oh, Klavdia, that's a Russian name." So it's just the Russian version of Claudia. But yeah, so we met halfway through doing my MBA, and I was originally wanting to be an attorney, hence the personal email address that you see that looks like a business one. So I got that. It's a personal one. I don't use it for business at lawyer.com, so I don't confuse clients. But we met then, and it was like, "Hey, let's just start the conversation." You know, but yeah, it was definitely, I was definitely coming in wounded. So I wasn't the whole woohoo, we met and it was love at first sight. And I saw a dove and a hologram of Jesus. You know, it's like, yeah. So I was like the wounded warrior, like, wait, he's a potential, but I don't know. But yeah, this was back in October of 2017, or excuse me,
Wowzer.
2007.
Okay.
2007. What am I saying? I'm like,
I
I
was
was
like
mixing up my dates.
2017. I was like,
Yeah.
the math ain't mathing.
Yeah.
Okay. So
There you go.
you guys get married. You started your started your career. I'm assuming she has her career going, correct?
Yes, yeah. She's
Okay.
been a physician since like 2000, you know. So yeah, so
Okay.
23 years, 24 years now. Yeah.
So my guy goes from park bench, stomach growling, and I'm going to solve a mystery for you. The reason
Sure.
that you were so hungry, the reason you were so hungry is because the weed you were smoking, that gives you too much. So you out there
There
smoking
you
weed.
go. Is this
But in any
me?
case,
I think in the Bible it says how you say in First Chronicles stimuli. No, yeah, there it is.
so
That's the
this.
NEV, New Ebonics version, right?
The
No,
new
there it is.
Ebonic version. So this dude's got his got your MBA, your wife who's a physician. Everything is like God is really working, and you're like, I'm blessed. You have your first daughter.
Yeah, it was a big blessing there. We're like, hey, I always tell my clients too professionally, I'm like, we're older, younger parents. You know, our first daughter was born December 26th, day after Christmas, 2012. And when we were pregnant, or my wife was pregnant, one of the emotional times at 5 months, we found out, hey, you're having a girl. You know, it's a boy or girl. Exciting times. But then the doctor says, we hear a certain pattern. It's amazing with technology and medical expertise. They can tell by the sound of her heartbeat at 5 months in the womb that it was an irregular sound And they said, we're concerned that she may have a heart condition. And I was amazed that they could tell that just by the sound. And there was a condition called congenital heart disease, or technically tetralogy of Fallot, which means that there's a major artery from your heart to your lungs that if it doesn't connect properly, used to call it blue baby syndrome, where the babies would turn blue, they didn't get enough oxygen, they die within a few days. So they were like, hey, we're going to need to have, she's going to need to have open heart surgery as a newborn when she's like 7 days old.
Okay.
So that was like a blow during the pregnancy, because we're like, whoa, what does that mean? You know,
there was also, if you don't mind, like, how did you and your wife process, like, during that time when you got that diagnosis, how did you and your wife process that spiritually?
Yeah. No, great question. It was an emotional thing that day. I remember after work, I remember having to go back to the office, and then her hearing, ironically, her like OB checkups were like 2 minutes from my office. It was like two buildings over. So I go right back to work, and I'm just like, it's like time stood still, you know, and I was doing like, you know, sales at that time on the financial side, and I'm like, I need to kind of take a breather for a couple of hours here before I jump on the phone and try to bring energy to selling a financial product. And that was a rough one. We talked it through. We're like, okay, what does this mean? Now, from growing up in the streets, one way of thinking that I developed is really just called circumspection, of just thinking, well, you really think about every potential consequence before you act. So we had to say, you know what? What could this mean? This could mean that, is she going to survive the birth? We could end up having a miscarriage or giving birth to a stillborn child who dies out of the womb. This could mean that, what if she has like severe disabilities throughout her life? It could mean that, what if she dies, you know, at a young age? And so we talked that through rather than ducking and dodging it. You know, some people get into this, I don't want to talk about it, let's be positive. I'm like, I'd rather face it head on. Because rather than running from fear, I've learned that it's going to catch up to you anyway. And fear is like credit. You know, you pay now, you address it now, you address it later, but later there's a lot more interest and it's a lot harder to deal with. So we had a very direct conversation, allowed ourselves to express what we feel to each other. Definitely was in prayer throughout, but also too with our close circle of friends, just soliciting prayers, man, and getting open to say, hey, this is a challenging time. But I also think that one of the things that does help me from my earlier start is that I don't feel exempt from trials coming my way. You know, in Romans 3:23, it's like, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. So spiritually speaking, I know that I deserve hell, and so does my wife. Now, if somebody is not from a faith-based, you know, background, that could sound weird. So I'm not trying to sound negative or pessimistic. What I'm sharing is that on a spiritual tip, that, you know, I know that my sin separated me from God, and I deserve hell, but he chooses to have grace on me. And because of that, I'm not exempt from any challenge coming my way. So we didn't really struggle with feeling like, hey, this isn't fair. But it was certainly like, God, we don't desire this, but it's here. So let's deal with it.
Okay. And so as time goes on, so that's at 5 months. You're able to deliver Aaliyah and successful birth. And then what happens?
So she's there. We were actually at New York Presbyterian Hospital, literally there through day after Christmas through New Year's. She was in the NICU for 3 weeks.
Okay.
The doctor, ironically, happened to be on vacation when she was born. So it was like, hey, instead of doing it at like 2 days old, can we wait till the 7th day when he comes back? We're like, we're here in New York, so we're literally in a hotel room in New York, you know, there for 3 weeks. Wife was in the hospital for 5 days. We're going back and forth. And, you know, 7 days, she has the open heart surgery. Did really well, came off of it. They gave her another 2 weeks or so to recover. After about three and a half weeks, we brought her home from the NICU. And I'm grateful for God's grace, because, man, that was over $400,000 in medical expenses.
Oh, wow.
Although we came out of pocket, maybe 30 grand, you know, but it was like expensive time, but she was doing well, you know. So had the whole, for the parents that know what newborns, NG tube, little tube that goes up the nose to kind of try to feed her milk through a machine just to give her chest some time to heal with her little baby sternum. But so we came back and we're grateful for successful surgery, but that was one of two. You know, they put a temporary connector between that heart and lungs, but they said, hey, we need to go back in and use artery tissue so that way the temporary connector thing that can actually grow with her. So it was definitely an emotional time. We had some people that were like, hey, we just believe in God that she's not going to need the surgery, right? And they visited us up in the hospital, and we're like, well, we appreciate the faith, but she does need the surgery, and she's going to have the surgery. So they're like, oh, well, wait, what? And I never try to dismiss anybody's prayer of healing, but also I feel like, you know, our faith and medicine can really complement one another, and they're not mutually exclusive.
Right. Well, that's good. And so how did she end up passing?
So it was literally the day before. I remember that Monday, April 29th, we were getting ready to go the next day, April 30th. She was going to the hospital to do a pre-op check-in. They were like, hey, we're going to have her schedule her surgery in another week or two, have her come in. We had a sister living with us who was in our singles ministry, who was our full-time nanny. So that morning, you know, she literally had her sleeping in a little rocker thing that little sort of infants are in. Yeah. She went to go feed her and she wouldn't wake up. And then she's like shaking her, like, hey, Aaliyah, trying to tap her. And then the sister really got nervous and scared and was like, I just slapped her like she's not responsive. She called my wife, hysterical and panicking, saying she's not responding. So then my wife calls me. I'm getting a cup of coffee with the colleague, and we come back. I left my cell phone at the desk. One of the guys calls me and says, hey, JD, your wife called the 800 number trying to get a hold of you to my firm. I'm like, why would she call the 800 number? And I'm like, oh, I left my cell phone at the desk. I go there. I call my wife. All she said was, oh, my God, I'm at the hospital with the baby. And I just said, I'm on my way. I hung up the phone and I grabbed my stuff. I'm running out. One of my colleagues is like, JD, what are you running so fast for? I was like, my daughter's in the hospital. He's like, oh, man, do you need a ride? I was like, nah, I'm good. I hop in the car and I just felt like emotionally, like something had opened up my chest. I just started crying. And I feel like God gave me revelation that my daughter died on the way there. Because I had this thought of like, Aaliyah died. And then I was like, all right, is that Satan? Is it God preparing me or is it Satan trying to tempt me? I wasn't sure. So she literally, one of the side effects of this condition is that your heart just stops randomly. So in essence, it's like a cardiac arrest, you know? So I go in there, I walk in to the security guy. I'm like, hey, my name's so-and-so. And a doctor standing right there goes, Mr. Dunn, can you follow me, please? So she stopped the security guy from even checking me in. So I'm walking, and that was like the Green Mile walk because it was a long walk. She said, so we got a call that a child went into cardiac arrest. She's like, so they brought her in and they were doing, trying to help, you know, help her and see if they could revive her. And then she goes, I don't have good news for you. And right before I walk into the room, she says, the baby died. And I see my wife sitting on the table, holding our daughter on a hospital bed, surrounded by three doctors, a police officer, and one of her head nurses who dropped it. And my wife is just crying. And she just kept saying, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm like, so what happened? And I'm like, it's okay. It's okay. What happened? She's holding my daughter and she just looks like she's asleep. No discoloration or anything. Touching her. And it was like, literally, they tried to revive her. Her heart stopped, you know. I literally held her for about 2.5 hours after she died. And they had another mom who lost a child who was a photographer. And they said, hey, if you'd like, we have a family room where we have a woman that will come and take complimentary pictures with you and your daughter just to be, just to have a last memory. If you would like, we're like, yes, because we don't know what's what. But as I held her, I was just like, wow, it doesn't seem real, you know, but yeah, very surreal time.
So take us to, obviously, there's a surreal portion doing the preparations for the memorial and all of that. How was your faith affected after that?
You know, it was ironically, it was a faith building time because when you study things about our faith, it's easy, it's very hypothetical until you go through the storm. You know, it makes me think about when they advertise watches, and I like to collect watches, but when they're like, hey, this watch has 1,000 meter, you know, water resistance, or this is waterproof under this or that. If you ever see those behind the scenes videos where they do testing and there's like banging and drilling and throwing it in, like it was really a time of like, okay, is what I believe really real? You know? And immediately I go home after being there for a couple hours. We change and I've got a suit on and have the time. We wife and I just change into like some workout gear, sweatpants, and all that. We're like, yeah, our bunch of friends from our fellowship are already at the house, like in shock. And we just said, guys, we're just going to change. And we're going to this seaside park in Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is by the Long Island Sound. We're just going to pray. You know, we went out, prayed with really no, I don't even know how, if it was an hour or two. Then we just prayed and just said, hey, let's just spit this out to God. And we thank God for allowing us to have her for 4 months and 3 days. We also expressed our hurt, but we also said, hey, we know we're not exempt, and that somehow God would actually use this to help other parents that may have actually lost children, but that he would just guide us. We just prayed for healing. We're like, sometimes you're like, God, if you can do this, then we'll heal. I was like, I don't even know how he's going to heal us, but I was just convinced that he had the ability to heal us. We went and prayed for a couple hours, started notifying family and friends, came back. It really felt an initial layer of surrender. You know, she died 2 weeks before Mother's Day. You know, not that there's ever a good time, but one of the surreal things is that, you know, the cemetery folks were like, hey, we wanted to get the headstone up before Mother's Day for you. And I remember on Mother's Day, another brother in our fellowship, his daughter was born. And then we said, hey, we'll come to the hospital to visit you to say congratulations. And I'm showing them a picture of my daughter's headstone. And I'm like, wow, we're really happy of how it came out. And we're looking at his daughter was just born. And we're like, man, they're happy on how she came out. And I was like, you know what? It's only through our relationship with God that we could even have this conversation. I'm like, because without God, how many people who just lost a daughter 2 weeks before Mother's Day and on Mother's Day go congratulate a friend without there being any awkwardness, you know? Yes, it was very surreal, but it actually helped us to see that, man, let's pray for healing. You know, certainly started therapy, took a couple of months off of work myself. Wife took a couple of weeks off and wanted to get back. We took a little mini vacation to Mexico, but it was a process of uncertainty and just this emptiness of heart, you know. Very surreal.
And how did that impact you as you were preparing to have, or as you had a desire to have more children?
Yeah, definitely. We were,
How did
that's a
that
good
impact your
question.
faith?
It definitely, at first, you know, one practical thing is I had this bit of PTSD with it, where every time I saw a child sleeping, I thought the child was dead. You know, so if somebody was holding a baby or something, I'm like, are they okay? Or if a kid was taking a nap or something in the house. I mean, it was, we had that desire to have a child, but we also knew that we're like, let's take time to pace ourselves and get therapy so that we don't rush to have another child to replace her and then not do the healing work from the grieving process. So we were like, let's just pause and really take it now. In between time, a lot of friends were having kids. There was a lot of baby showers that at times were tougher to go to, you know, but we're like, hey, let's just go and be happy for others. A lot of kids' birthdays, or I remember being at a birthday party, you know, one of my wife's best friends, she was pregnant at the same time, and her son was 2 weeks, born exactly 2 Wednesdays before our daughter. And I remember being at his birthday party, remembering that, wow, my daughter would be the same age. And it was must have been 10 or 12 kids there. I had to step out in the middle of it in December. Oh, it was cold and pray, and I'm just in tears because I was like, this loss was coming over me. You know, we were getting older. We're like, hey, we're older, younger parents not getting pregnant. What's going on? We looked at in vitro, a couple of rounds of in vitro, and $20,000 plus out of pocket later. We're like, hey, it's not successful. Seeing my wife deal with the depression of the loss and being discouraged of not, and just trying to pray to be surrendered. Then we said, you know what, let's look at adoption, you know. And I was starting up my own firm at the time. So December 2014, I was like, God, if we do adoption, you know, we're doing a program where they select you to be the parents. I was like, any day, if we're selected, I'm starting a firm any day after April 15th. Well, we actually got called April 16th. I was like, I didn't expect it to be that soon afterwards, God. But we got called, and then we were selected to be our second daughter, Ariana's parents, when she was born on the 15th, which is funny because I tax day and I work in a financial field. Selected to be her parents on the 16th. And then by the 17th, she was 2 days old. We were in Texas finalizing the adoption. So yeah, very, very surreal there, but God is blessed.
Okay. And then your third daughter.
Mm-hmm.
How did that occur?
So technically, so it'll be third child, which third will be child. My son. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, you mentioned that at the beginning. Fully forgive me.
No, it's all good. It's all good. So what's surreal, and this is where it showed me God's timing of it all. So my prayer of like, God, for selected to be, you know, someone's parents, any day after April 15th, we get called April 16th. After we adopt her, you know, my wife loses her mom a couple of months later. And then all of a sudden we find out a month after that, that we're pregnant with my son after trying to get pregnant for years. You know, they say, you heard a lot of stories like that. As soon as you adopt, you get pregnant. We're like, we're trying, ain't happening. My wife gets pregnant with my son, his due date, April 16th, the next year. I was like, wow, what are the odds? He actually came March 29th. So I jokingly said, as I like to be on time, I guess he came early. But they're 11 and a half months apart. The day they finalized the adoption, April 29th in Texas, 2 years to the date, was our first daughter Aaliyah's death anniversary. And I was like, wow, this is crazy. It just showed me God's hand in orchestrating all of this. So now when the kids drive us crazy and drive us to want to use profanity after reading the Bible, we're like, hey, this is what we prayed for. So let's be grateful. So my son, AJ, so I'm James Alexander Dunn. He's Alexander James Dunn. So we call him AJ as I go by JD. And and he's a jokester too. So they're 11 and a half months apart, like Irish twins here, as they call it. But 2.5 weeks a year, they're the same age. But
wow. That's really inspiring.
Yeah.
I know one of the challenges for me, and again, not even having close to your story, like our stories are vastly different. But I know when I became a Christian in 19, one of the things that, I don't know if anyone said it, but I felt it, but you walk with God, you obey, you find purpose, you know, and blessings just come. You walk with God and blessings come. And the first year I had some romantic interest that didn't work out, and I was like depressed, and God take me. And so that just shows you how fragile and privileged I was. And so getting married, honestly, I had several other things that occurred, came and paid ministry, which is a dream, but my father passed away. Both my grandparents passed away. My grandfather died on my birthday. And so these things started happening, like life started happening. And even my wife, we got married. We couldn't get pregnant for almost 4 years. Nothing wrong physically. Everything seemed all right. And then God bless us, we had a child. It was fantastic. It's funny you share the story because my wife's friends were getting pregnant all around us, and it was so hard to go to the baby showers, to show up at the hospital for friends.
Because
you know, a little bit way different than your situation, but we're like, man, trying, God, what are you doing? So we're able to finally have a son. And then 2 years after our first son was born, we were pregnant again. We lost the child. And to your point, going in for the ultrasound, hearing no heartbeat.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I did not handle it the way you did. in facing the realities. For me,
sure.
kind of suffered in silence. And my wife and I really didn't have any deep discussions about it. And so we both dealt with it in our kind of own way.
Yeah.
And we banded together, but we never really had discussions like you and your wife. And so it wasn't until years later that God was able to use that pain to help other people. And I didn't understand that at the point.
Yeah, sure.
But I think the challenge for me, and I share all that to share, one of the challenges for me in our fellowship, one of the things was the certainty of God's blessings. The certainty that if you're reading your Bible every day, you're praying every day, you're fasting, you're about your purpose, you're about the mission, everything's going to go well. And even though I'm reading my Bible and nothing in the Bible says that, you know, Jesus himself, who was perfect, died on the cross. Paul, who lived for him, suffered. But in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, everything is going to go well all the time. And it was such a challenge because I felt like the realities of life, but in my mind, this image or the paradigm of walking with God and all blessings, you know, you hear the things, triumphal procession in Corinthians, you know, going from strength to strength, all the blessing passages you hear over and over again. But the realities are there's the valleys. And it's so inspiring to hear how you and your wife handled it. It sounds like you used reality.
Yeah.
And gratitude. And perseverance.
Yeah.
A step at a time.
Now, so true. And to your point there with that certainty of God's blessings, you know, even when it comes to the media, there's this perception of, oh, you're following God, you just have a blessed life. And it's like, well, we got to really look at, you know, and even the whole concept where God showed me, you know, when it comes to unconditional love, you know, when people talk about that, I was like, unconditional love is not biblical. You know, now I know the heart behind when people say that, but God actually puts a condition on his love and how he instructs us. He's like, love as I have loved you, forgive as I have forgiven you. And when we say unconditional love, what we usually mean is don't hold the person's like sin against them, but it's not about the person. I have to look at how has God loved me, and then how am I tempted to love this person? So my reference point is God, not so much whether or not the person deserves forgiveness. So the condition is we have to look at God's example. So it's actually counterintuitive, but it was an epiphany for me that, because if we think about unconditional love, people are like, well, what about if you're raped or abused? How could you unconditionally love somebody? It's not about the person. The condition is how is God loving me? When I look at me and I say, I deserve hell because my sin put Jesus on the cross, and the fact that he chose to forgive me for that, that's what helps me to kind of let go and be surrendered of after experiencing sexual abuse when I was 9 years old, you know, to say, I can forgive. That doesn't mean we're BFFs and we're hanging out, but my decision to forgive my abuser was not based on their performance, acknowledgement, or repentance, or what have you. It was really because of looking at God, how God loved me. That's one piece, and then not feeling entitled, because God's like, hey, I'll never forsake you. He didn't say, I'll make sure everything's all good. But he's like, but when you go through the valley, and when life is unfair, as Jesus dealt with that, he's like, God, don't hold their sins against them. They don't know what they're doing. His focus was, hey, my relationship with God. So that was an epiphany for me. And it's not just linguistics. I think it is a mindset and a shift set to say, because I think a lot of people struggle with unconditional love. I like the idea of how can I actually love somebody that has severely wronged me or wronged people, you know? And I'm like, well, it's because we're looking at them relative to how they've hurt us versus for me, I've had to learn to wrestle and say, I'm going to choose to respond how God loves me, not so much what the person deserves. And it doesn't mean it's easy, but at least gives me a framework.
Absolutely. And that, I may have you on for another series talking about that. But if we can, real quick,
Sure.
Let's move on to you had a cancer diagnosis. When was
Yes.
that?
That was literally the day after Father's Day 2022 when I
Oh,
found out.
okay.
It was a crazy time. My father, who wasn't around when I was present, we actually got close as an adult. I just chose to initiate with him, which is a whole nother story. But instead of one brother, I have four brothers and three sisters. So my dad is, I'm mixed of, my mom was Native American, African American. So I just grew up saying, hey, I'm black. But my dad is Puerto Rican. So I look Latino. I'm African American, but yet my last name is Irish. So I'm officially a mutt. Yeah, it's like, gotta love it. But we
Goodness.
got close as an adult, and he actually had triple bypass heart surgery just from unfortunately abusing alcohol, and his organs and his heart were shot. He had two, three heart attacks. He died 3 weeks before Father's Day, 2022. So naturally, you lose a parent, you start thinking about your own mortality. I'm kicking myself because I ignored as a typical guy, like, oh, I do these group workouts. I thought I pulled a muscle on my thigh. I ignored it for like 10 months. Finally, my wife's like, you should probably get that checked out. I had an MRI the day after Father's Day, literally that same year, just 3 weeks after my father died. My doctor called me within 20 minutes. I was still in the parking lot. I didn't even pull out of the facility yet. He said, hey, they just called me. They never called me that fast. It's looking like cancer. Where I thought was a pulled muscle was actually an 8 by 4 inch tumor in my left thigh, which is crazy. And it was like in between the muscle. It wasn't on the surface of the skin, which would have probably been more obvious. So my stiff kind of left quad muscle was a tumor, spindle cell sarcoma. It's like 1% of all cancers that get diagnosed. It's very rare. They don't really know how you get it. But the old treatment 30, 40 years ago was amputation. And so that it was like the life rock, my whole life and world was rocked at that point.
Wowzers. And so take us through that process. So your father passes, you're diagnosed with cancer. Now, how do you handle
Diagnosed.
that in your faith?
That was a whirlwind. A day later, they're like, yeah, not only are you cancer free, hey, but I check on my chart. And they're like, oh, by the way, we just did a random COVID test and you're COVID positive, you know? And I was like triple vaccinated. I was like, great, here we go. Something else, boom, bono, bono, you know?
So
And
we'll go back up.
I'm
So
like,
you're diagnosed with cancer,
right. And
and
then they
then
were
you
like,
get
oh, but
COVID.
they were like, they did a COVID test just in case. So then I find out 12 hours later, they're like, oh, by the way, you got COVID too. So I was like, man. So then I was thinking, you know, my wife had it once or twice. I was like, that stinks. But I was like, I'll probably just have the sniffles for a couple of days, whatever. But I had to quarantine with my kids because, you know, they were exposed. So I couldn't even have downtime to process the cancer diagnosis, you know, fully, because I'm like, wait. But that version, and it could be the stress of my father's death and the new diagnosis stress. COVID kicked my behind. I had the real, like, I was like, oh, I was in intense, like, pain for a couple days, and then had some treatment thing, and then I was better, like, within 3 or 4 days. But that was humbling to have to quarantine with my kids that were, you know, at the time only 6 and 7, while we sort of processed this. Actually, there were 5 and 6 at the time, and I'm like, man, it's a whirlwind. I remember first thing I thought of, and professionally, I'm a financial planner, so I was like, I had to update my will and my legal documents. You know, I didn't know if it was curable or not. I remember just having times of just, I think I have a video recording of it where I just burst out in tears because I'm like, I didn't grow up with my dad and my mother died at 14. So my immediate concerns, I wasn't really concerned spiritually because I'm like, I have a relationship with God. And financially, I have things set up where my family will be taken care of financially. But my concern was, I don't want my kids growing up without a father like I did and how rough it was. And secondly, I was like, man, I don't want to collapse in front of my kids, you know, and have them traumatized, like, hey, dad's here convulsing or, you know, whatever. So that was a concern. And I just remember saying, all right, well, let me just journal that through and pray it out. 'Cause I'm like, rather than duck and dodge it again, I'm like, let me just play it out and really express that to God. Rather, some people do take that journey privately, but I was like, you know what? There's a whole lot of unknowns, and on social media, I'm connected with overall, probably 1,000+ and my initial contacts, but it's like tens of thousands of people that are also fellow believers online. So mm-hmm. I decided to just go public with it. Like, and my motivation in doing that was I just need as much prayer as I can get, you know? Mm. And so I was like, I don't have the energy to make 1,000 phone calls, but I can just kick it out there to different groups. And so I just decided I'm going to put that out there. It was humbling. And then it was like, hey, am I going to need, you know, chemotherapy? Am I going to need surgery? They're like, well, surgery to remove it and radiation. At first, they're like, surgery and radiation, you may not need chemo. You know, when I had my consult with the doctors, we went through and they were like, well, here's why we recommend chemo. Any tumors over 10 centimeters recommended. Yours is 20.
Oh.
Yeah. They're like, it's optional. But I was just like, I was like, well, in my case, I'm like, hey, I'll take all the help I can get. Nah, I'm not looking to take a shortcut. And I was thinking, like, dang, that means I'm going to lose my hair and I'm going to be either Dr. Evil or Lord Voldemort here. But I'm like, what's going on? And so I remember thinking of that. They're like, you hear it, go back. And then the doctor, you know, at that point, we're talking with him. And I remember my wife being on the appointment with me. We're asking questions. But when we realized I needed chemo, you know, that's when she choked up, you know, was like tearing up to ask a question. And I'm like, man, he walked us around the floor and said, yeah, these are the chairs and the rooms where you would have chemo and be set up. And this was like 6 to 8 hours a day, 3 days at a time in 3 week increments. So it was 21 rounds of chemo, 25 rounds of radiation surgery. They removed about a third of my quad muscle on my left leg. And they also have a titanium rod in my left femur. But now, you know, that was a whirlwind, not knowing, like, which way is this going to go? You know, chemotherapy just, it drains you physically. You know, radiation has its impact where my leg was like discolored and nearly black and skin peeling like you're a burn victim or so and burn survivor. So it was a whirlwind, but I just said, you know what? I end up through journaling and really therapy was the epiphany there. I was like, I had anxiety, like, wait, I got this port catheter thing in my jugular vein where they give me chemo through. Wasn't used to feeling that. And it was a journey. I was just like, let me journal. Wife helped me out to really encourage me to seek therapy. And they had oncology therapists that specialize in helping people that are like, hey, if you're newly diagnosed, how do you process that? And it's a lot of unknowns. Thinking through, I started making a list of lessons I want my kids to know and let me write a personal letter in case I do die. So a lot of uncertainty. And I was just like, there was control versus influence. So I said, all I can control is choosing to be honest with God, with others, and also too, choosing to be honest with myself. Now, in my sinful nature, you know, similar with my daughter's loss, I jokingly told my wife, like, hey, if I become terminal, and this is the comedian side of me, I said, tell the Make-A-Wish Foundation that I want to go to the Bunny Ranch in Vegas for the weekend. I was like, but I was like, only if they hire you as my escort. But I'm like,
oh my gosh, this dude.
So needless to say, I was just like, I remember just feeling this, the sense of entitlement, like, oh, do I deserve to just like sin or something? And just, do I deserve to just say, what if we allowed ourselves to sleep with one person each? You know,
it was
a thought. And because my wife and I are transparent, it was just like, hey, these are some of the thoughts here. I was just like, yep, that's real. Didn't act on any of that. But I was like, let me just put it in the light. Yeah, I was like, let me just put it in the light and then take it a day at a time. Having young kids, I was like, how do we balance? How do we even talk to them about it? You know, we told them through, you know, it was a book called Someone I Love Has Cancer. It was a cartoon book that a mom wrote who said, here's how to explain to children what cancer is, you know? And then trying to draw out my children day to day, where I would ask them every day, do you have any questions for me? 90% of the time they did. They're like, Dad, feel bad for you. Oh, what is that? Because you're going to get zapped. You know, that's what the book used for, like, you know, radiation. But they thought it was like a laser that like takes out your hair. I was like, no, actually, it's not the radiation. It's the liquid medicine, the chemo that caused me to lose my hair. But I just tried to probe and let, you know, and ask them. The tougher part is when I got closer to my surgery, it was just like, Dad, I don't want you to have surgery. I don't want you to die. And I was like, so I was just like, well, thank you for sharing that. But I'm like, I'm actually having the surgery so that I don't die. It's actually going to help get rid of the cancer. But thank you for sharing that. And I just tried to ask my kids every day, do you have any questions for me? Thank them for expressing it. and give some reassurance. But it is surreal. I remember just walking by, seeing them brush their teeth or so, or taking my son to a baseball game or something, and just it became very surreal. I'm like, I'm sitting here not knowing, is this my last summer as a dad? You know, and even though I had some spiritual security personally, I was definitely concerned about how are they going to grow up, you know, and just praying. So I said, you know, I can only control me choosing to be honest with God. I can't control whether or not he honors that, because he doesn't say we won't go through these trials. He just says he won't forsake us.
Yeah.
And although that's comforting, it's also scary and humbling, because there's a, you know, when scriptures say, I won't give you more than you can bear, that means that you have the ability to bear. He didn't say about the desire to bear. Yeah. I mean, I have the desire to not bear a lot of things, you know.
Yeah.
I never want to hear about my children getting sexually abused as I was, but yet God doesn't say that'll never happen. He just says that I will guide you through it should it happen. And that can be discouraging at times, but I also say, you know what, I can only choose to be honest with where I am and pray that, you know, he does certain things in my favor.
So I'm grateful, actually, if we can back up a little bit when you shared about the conversation you had with your wife about the Bloody Ranch and all that stuff. And the reason, I know for some people, they're going to freak out and be like, oh my gosh. And one of the things we're called unpresentable parts, because here's the reality. There are real things that we think in our hearts and our souls that are outlandish, and we never know what we're going to feel or think in a situation until we're in that situation. And so we get it out before God, we get it out before one another. And that's, I know from my experience, it keeps us from acting on that, exposing it to the light, exposing those crazy things that, hey, this is just what I was feeling. I know for me, that actually gives me freedom in Christ. Man, I had this thought. It was crazy. You know, I think and I appreciate you sharing that. And I don't want people to freak out on that. Trust me, that is way more normal than you think. I know people might think, I know I've thought about my own death, about, man, I don't know about wife. We're getting remarried, having sex with some other dude. Like, just all that stuff. I don't want my kids raised by somebody else. And so all of those things, and even, you know, like my children, if I'm gone, would they be angry at God? Would they be bitter? Would they not make it? And so these are all real thoughts. And I think for us, there's a maturity. And the reason I'm really, really grateful you shared that, is for us to be able to understand that before God, he knows more than what we say. He knows what's going on in our hearts. So you might as well get it out. Get it out before him. Get it out before others. And then God can work. So you have your surgery. It's obviously successful because here you are.
Yes.
And so where are you at currently?
You know, so January 30th of 2023, it was like, hey, this is your first MRI after the surgery. We're going to see if the cancer is still present, you know, and they do these webinars there. And one of the webinar titles was called Scanxiety for cancer patients. And I was like, that's a good title, because when you go through these scans, you're like, is it there or is it not? Like, you don't know. And as of January 30th, 2023, cancer free, 100% cancer free by the grace of God. They're still monitoring me every 3 months. I have scans for the first 2 years, then it would be every 6 months and once a year. They're going to monitor me for 10 years, you know, as a precaution. But my rare form, it rarely comes back. They said if it does, it tends to be decades later. If it does, everybody's cancer is a little different. I'm just praying that that never does. So that's why at least once a year, I'll definitely be getting checked just in case, because it's all about early detection when it comes to cancer. I mean, literally, getting checked from 1 month to the next can mean the difference of whether or not you live or die, like if you're not careful with cancer. So for me, I'm cancer free, grateful for it.
Amen. So how has that impacted your outlook on life? All of these circumstances, the loss of Aaliyah, loss of your father, cancer. And so now obviously we have no idea what's coming in the future, but
Yeah.
like how has that impacted your faith, your walk with God, like even
Yeah.
your how you live your life now, how you experience your
Yeah.
faith now?
Right. No, it's a great question. For me, it's through journaling and going through the process. I hadn't finalized it yet, but I was working on a presentation called How Letting Cancer Take My Life Saved It. Yeah. And really, it's not so much that it took it in terms of ending my life, but rather it took me in a different direction. So now gratitude, being present, and I'm sure you and Sam know, having raised two near adult age boys, is how you have to be so deliberate with your time when you've got kids. Because it's like, oh, I want to do this. 5 minutes later, 2 years go by. And it's just like, so I'm realizing, like, well, I've got to be very deliberate, very intentional. We look at, all right, with our kids, what do we, our biggest desire is that we create an atmosphere where they have their own desire to want to have their own relationship with God when we get older, when they get older, without pressure from us. So wife and I are like, what do we want to instill in them? Integrity, honesty, discipline, consideration. We're like, what are we doing in our parenting? What input can we get from older parents? And how are we spending our time so that we can facilitate developing those skills in our kids, and those values? So being very deliberate, very grateful, and learning to just be big picture, and think long term when it comes to even dealing with my own issues of kids will bring out, they can bring out, most people could see me as a patient person, but the kids can bring out the inner hood side of me, like what, or I could just be ready, where
Especially
I'm
your
just ready to
son.
catch a case. You're like, hey, I jokingly told folks that, hey, I used to dream about my kids being born, and now I fantasize about their death at times.
Oh, my
But I'm like, yeah,
goodness.
but they will drive you crazy. But I remember thinking, like, me working on my anger is not just about working on anger, but it's thinking through, man, what kind of a husband do I want my daughter to select? We've heard so many things about women, like, well, my dad yelled and was abusive, and now I'm with an abusive guy. So really thinking long term and generationally, thinking through for my son to be patient and not to be overly aggressive with him so that he doesn't be aggressive with other kids, So it's given me a perspective to think generationally, think more eternal, think long term, and to be very deliberate, and to really just stay real, stay open, and clinging on to my real relationships. I made a note that I think the biggest thing that helps with those valleys that I want to encourage the audience with, if you are part of a Christian-based group, is that you need friendships beyond the fellowship. And what I mean by that is that some of us are like, if you're around, hey, it's great to see you, but you don't hear from some of those people. Not everybody understands how it is to be struggling and maybe not part of a fellowship for months and not have anybody call you, but then have everybody question you when you do pop up as if they were concerned. And you're like, yet you haven't called, So for me, I'm like, it's friendship beyond the fellowship. There's a lot of folks who were part of our fellowship that I still keep in touch with decades later because I'm like, we have a friendship, and a brotherhood that's beyond the faith. And you need friends like that, that we all have our own individual relationship with God. But a lot of folks that don't get real with some of these thoughts, they can seem to be fine, and all of a sudden they disappear. And we're like, wow, what happened to this person? They seem to be so happy, so well, so put together. It's like, if you don't have friendships beyond the fellowship where you can be real and let your sin out, not somebody that's going to enable your sin and not challenge you, but somebody you're comfortable enough being the real you around. And that does mean your sin comes out, but you also know that they're going to listen without judgment, but they will redirect you with God's word. And that's been a huge thing that's helped me throughout the years, is having those friendships. And I'd say the biggest lesson is learning how to get help, when I'm hurting, and learning that it's my responsibility to share with people how to help me. And if they try to help me and unintentionally hurt me, let me have grace because, hey, I got issues too. So it's helped me to not be judgmental about how other people process their pain, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, but to be patient and not judgmental. When it comes to that, one of the silver linings that I'll kind of, with the closing comment with, is that as we went through that, we prayed about God using our daughter's death to help others. Well, You know, I used to visit the cemetery so often. I knew the couple that managed it, and I saw that there was a headstone right beside my daughter a few months later of a little baby girl that was 3 days old. I wrote that family a letter, and I gave it to the couple that managed the cemetery. I was like, can you just pass it on? I'm like, we don't know each other from Adam. You know, we're just fellow parents who also lost a child. If you ever want to grab a cup of coffee or lunch or dinner, wife and I would love to. Here's my number. Well, they called us 2-3 months later. Long story short, the wife studied the Bible off and on for a couple of years, did not choose to become a Christian, but she brought another friend who studied in a few months, and then she became a Christian. You know, that same wife or mom who lost her daughter, we kept the friendship. She studied off and on for 5 years.
Wow.
And during COVID, she was baptized into Christ. So we've seen two women and two families impacted. We're praying for the husbands. They're more open to friendship, but not necessarily the gospel. But through that time, you know, God really used the pain and in my wife's relationship to help convert two other women through, you know, and one just indirectly. Ironically, the other woman that was converted, both of them are nurses, but one of them is actually an oncology nurse who was like giving me tips later on my cancer treatment. So just never know how God will use, you know, some of our misery becomes our ministry, as they say. It's a whirlwind. But that was our prayer, because we said, how many people are going through this without God that need to talk to somebody who's gone through it with God? Not that we're any better than them. We're just fellow strugglers that have just tapped into God's grace. And can we share with you what we're learning as we're on the journey?
That's amazing. That's really, really encouraging. It's funny how the Holy Spirit works and allows things to occur in our lives that have nothing to do with us. That's one of the lessons I learned about suffering in Christ is, you know, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 through 11. I remember reading that over and over again. And the idea, Paul said that the comfort we receive overflows. We suffer so that the comfort we receive from him overflows into others. And I realize that, because again, whenever I suffer, again, my privileged mindset, I always thought, oh, I did something wrong. God doesn't love me, yada, yada. But it doesn't have anything to do with me. It's me sticking it out with God, me experiencing his comfort. And then that overflows to others, and the grace and the love that he's shown me, I can extend out. And so, again, to a much lesser degree, when we lost our child in 08, we've been able to comfort so many other couples that have gone through the same thing and counsel them through it. And it's amazing. So that's really encouraging. Lastly, I know for our audience, they don't know this, but one of the reasons this podcast occurred, and James and I talked about it a little bit beforehand, James started doing stand-up comedy. And so I saw this online, and I'm going to ask you about that really briefly. I saw him do his comedy online, and it inspired me. I thought, this has got to be because of the cancer. He thought, let me just make this happen. And so my thinking was, I don't need to have cancer, but do something. Do something that maybe you want to do. Another lesson was, I was teaching my sons, you got to try to fail at something. So I was like, let's try a podcast. So any case, James, you want to share a little bit about your comedy really briefly, and then we're going to close it up.
Yeah, sure. I think that, you know, it's one of those things where since I was literally 11 or 12 years old, just loved stand-up comedy. And I think from going through so much childhood trauma, I just enjoyed laughing. It was like a way to disconnect from like reality, but also to be able to find some humor in it. And there is sort of, over the years, I've developed it. I've hosted a lot of parties kind of just for friends or even within our church. I end up emceeing a lot of things, being like a facilitator of discussions. And I just, you know, pepper humor throughout. Sometimes it's not even an effort, you know, but it's one of those things where I find it's very therapeutic and does help with laughter. So I had never done any formal training. So I did a 6-week workshop where, you know, took 20 hours of preparation to be able to do a 6-minute routine at a professional comedy club. And it was filmed, but it was a bucket list item. And now I'm part of a whole network of comedians throughout Connecticut. and beyond. I get invited to shows all the time. Now it's a matter of finding the time to do it again, because it literally, when you see these guys do a 1 hour special, it's like 100 hours plus of prep. To do 5 minutes can take you 10, 20 hours. So it looks, comedians make it look simple, but when you do real technical comedy writing, it is a process of stretching. But I enjoy it. I find that, you know, keeping the humor, I was like, if Titus was on here, I know he did some bodybuilding. I was like, you know, in campus days, I look like a bodybuilder, but now I went from bodybuilder to bodybuilder bear. All right, now. So that's what I'm trying to work it. I'm trying to go from the third to the first trimester as far as belly density now. So I'm trying to work it.
That's funny. And it is funny. A lot of the best comedians, historically best comedians, have trauma in their background.
Darkest backgrounds. Yeah, so true.
It's born out of pain. Yes. Some of the best comedians.
Yeah. But amen. So true.
So, James, I should have done this at the beginning, and maybe, anyway, we'll do it here.
Sure.
One of the questions we ask at the beginning of every episode, and now we're at the end, is what's unpresentable about you today? What's unpresentable, meaning what's a part of you that's struggling today?
Sure.
I know for me, the unpresentable part was, man, this is my first interview, and I wanted to be... You know, whenever you're doing something, you have somebody in mind, like, do it like this guy or do it like that guy or whatever, as opposed to yourself. And so the anxiety of, you know, can I be me?
Yeah,
that makes sense. Sure. So in any case, that's what I'm feeling a little bit anxious about. Yourself?
Yeah, definitely. I think one unpresentable part was, I think for me, it's just always having, I always keep present what my sinful nature is. So by nature, I'm a coward, conflict avoider, and I lack discipline and character. And when I dropped out of high school, it took me, did an extra year, but I didn't really know how to study. I had times where I flat out failed semesters in college. It took 8 years to get a 4-year degree. I actually had a full scholarship where I went from a community college to then going to Harvard Extension School at night. The scholarship was going to cover tuition, books, and my rent while I finished Harvard. But they were like, if you drop any class or fail a class, you lose the scholarship. I went through the worst breakup in my life, and I chose to withdraw instead of fail because it wouldn't hit my GPA as hard. But I literally lost the scholarship for my lack of discipline. And I've had times where, as an adult, I work in the financial field now, and professionally I give millionaires advice, and yet I've had times where I'm just like struggling financially. And I remember the days in campus, like, man, wait, I'm behind on my rent, or I owe this roommate money for the phone bill. And so for me, that unpresentable piece is not seeing myself as a financially irresponsible, lacking discipline, homeless teenager, you know, and then not letting that hinder how I pursue success now. Because I literally give millionaires advice professionally, which is kind of surreal when I look at where I came from. But I also have to remember, and God's, this is a work in progress, where rather than feeling like I'm not worthy, Saya, can I help you, my Lord? You know, it's like, hey, I'm just as successful as they are in my own right. Not saying I'm balling like I'm a millionaire with the chalice or something, but I think that sort of self-doubt, not so much imposter syndrome, but more so feeling unworthy. You know, I'm nothing. I used to always just jokingly say, oh, I'm nothing, I'm nobody, I'm still learning how to read and write my name, you know. And but that lack of self-esteem, and for me, the thing that helps is that I had to realize that my value is not so much who I am, like I've earned it, but it's whose I am and who I belong to. I remember when, I think it was Brad and Angelina Jolie, when they first started adopting, the first pictures of their kids sold for $45 million, you know. It's crazy. A photograph you can probably print for a nickel, maybe 25 cents if it's high resolution. But ordinary things take on extraordinary value depending on who they belong to.
Ooh.
And what I realize is that my worth is not in me. Oh, I've earned it or whatever. I give millionaires advice. Who cares? I'm not a millionaire. But it's not even in that. It's the fact that I belong to God and that I've been washed with the blood of Jesus. So because of whose I am, I have value and I can have confidence in that versus who I am. But my unpresentable part is that by default, I go to that, well, who I am, you know, based on my, oh, I'm nobody. Who am I? I'm not worthy. And that can be an ongoing struggle, you know.
Well, Big James, this has been fantastic. Honestly, it's super, super encouraging. Thank you. For those out there, you can reach us at www.unpresentableparts.com. Let me see if I can pull it up. I got it right here. This is our website. You can check out the Soon Come. You'll see what we're heading into next. You'll see the Eve edition, which is our Sam and Jasmine. So you'll be able to go there. If you want to ask questions, you can go on the website. You can send us an email and all that other stuff. But in any case, appreciate everybody being with us. Again, this is James Dunn. I'm Tim Blake. And until next time, peace.